Now, I'll make all the announcements about the final again on Monday, I think. I just want to finish this morning saying something about the third kind of irrationalism, which did persist, apart from the short outbursts of Dada. The letting go, as it were. And here I want to point out simply what you will read already in the Culture of Western Europe, this outburst of the creative person and political leader. This outburst that you have after the war, which is part of the general despair, perhaps disorganization, the idea that everything is in the marketplace, that you have these ideas of the poet and leader, and that you have it in Germany, as you will read in the Culture of Western Europe, there's quite a lot about it, with Stefan de Holder and the circle around that poet, and that you have it, of course, come to life in Italy with Gabriele D'Annunzio. Not only that D'Annunzio was an important poet, but that he also, after all, for 3 years, ruled the city of Fiume on the Adriatic in the name of Italian irredentism, in the name of Italian annexationism. So with D'Annunzio, this came alive, and as it came alive, a lot of things were tried out that were taken over later by mass movements and mass politics, especially in fascist Italy, such as the dialogue from the balcony, was the leading dialogue from the balcony with the crowd, was first done by D'Annunzio and Fiume, but many of these kind of things. Four, why this outburst? Well, it has to do really with two things, which I also want to mention very briefly. One is, of course, the new interest in the occult, the new interest in the secret, of which, oddly enough, Hitler is very much a part. That is to say, the war, the cataclysm after the war, is always in such disturbed time. People are more interested in the occult, the secret. They see the key to the universe through theosophy and through other occult movements. And certainly the Stefan de Holder circle, with its idea of the secret Germany, the secret sect which will redeem the nation, is part of that. D'Annunzio in Italy, much less so. Instead, I think he is a part really of the second idea. The idea that in modern mass movement, the poet has a definite place as the creator of a literature, a creator of a language. D'Annunzio at Fiume created much of the fascist language, the slogan, the shouts, whatever you call them, are created there. And so there was a place for the poet, and D'Annunzio everywhere exploited it. Now these kind of ideas of the occult and the mass movement are a part, if you like, of letting go, or perhaps to put it better, of finding irrational frameworks for a society, rather than keeping control, which is what we talked about with the architecture and all the other important cultural manifestations, even the cabaret of the Weimar Republic. But the most important part of this kind of letting go, the most important and vital part of this irrationalism comes, of course, with Oswald Spengler and his famous book, The Decline of the West. Now, before I go into Spengler and the Decline of the West, which I have to do a little more thoroughly, of 1922, I wonder if you have any questions about what I left it on yesterday, the last couple of lectures, when the what you might call the culture and rationality side of Weimar culture. Any questions about it? Yeah?
Can you define dominating architecture?
Well, an architecture like Helen White, that's dominating. It's dominating. It's unhuman. There's no humanity about it. It dominates you and it dominates the surrounding. It dominates heaven.
In terms of size
and inhumanity and abstract.
Uniformity.
Yeah. How is the emphasis in Bauhaus on form and content and functionalism related to what I assumed was later political dominance?
I don't know whether it's related to later political dominance. In that sense, what it's related to is in fascism, yeah, because there too you have the emphasis on order and harmony. Once again, the Bauhaus architecture is an architecture of order and harmony. And what became eventually, as we say, a dehumanizing tendency, a dominating tendency in the architecture itself by its monumentality. This the Bauhaus wanted to avoid. The Bauhaus was opposed to monumentality in architecture, but it became ever more monumental, as you see in yourself, which was in fact a kind of necessary growth with more and more things that would be put in these buildings. And it became more and more important to construct cheaply for the most space. The Bauhaus gave you the cheapest space, really, for construction. So it fits in Italy, come to that with the whole Roman revival, with the whole idea of classicism, the new Roman Empire. It is a kind of classical architecture in a sense of its emphasis on harmony and proportion, and over against the Baroque, let me say, yes? And over against ornamentation of all sorts. Ornamentation is out, functionalism is in, yes? Sure. Yes, anything else on that? This is your last opportunity on that subject. Yes.
Bauhaus is rather a dying institution.
No, I didn't mean to say that. It influenced our architecture today. So, inasmuch as it still is made readily, and they would have been very happy about that, for free fabrication, yes? All over the world. I would go so far to say, as you may know, there are only two universal styles of architecture ever in the history of the world. One is the Baroque, because the Baroque coincided with Catholic expansion. So wherever Catholicism went, the Baroque went, yes? And that meant it went to China, it went to Japan, it went all over the Orient, because the Baroque coincided with the great, you know. So I would say the Baroque is a universal architecture. It did not get across the Protestant countries like America very much, yes? But it went everywhere where the church went. So I would say the only second universal style of architecture, unfortunately, is the Bauhaus. And it went much more because it eventually determined all of the buildings. Baroque only really determined church buildings, yeah? You know what I mean? And some secular buildings. But the Bauhaus determined all buildings. So I say it is, and it was, and I think it still is, a universal style of architecture. How much you will vote against it is today, is anybody's guess. You see what I mean?
It's quite rational to see these squares of
right
angle without end. I think it's going getting too much credit.
Well, it however is the thing that was brought over here. I mean, you can trace that through. There's on the one hand in America the school of Frank Lloyd Wright, whom they first admired and then became the enemy, because Frank Lloyd Wright romanticized, you know, landscape and all of this sort of thing. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright said it's a very romantic building, you know, then a humbly square box. So, they were very important to all the great architects, you see, Le Corbusier, Gropius, you know, who then became the leading person of the Harvard School of Architecture, yes? All the others, Wagner, they all came over here, but not only over here. I mean, it What they wouldn't approve of in modern architecture is the monumental. Yeah? They try to keep it small, but not that small, because their chief pleasure was making factories and so on. And as you will see, or I mentioned it now, under the Nazis, Bauhaus architecture remained alive. That is to say, official Nazi buildings are neoclassicist, but let us say all army and navy buildings, and all buildings you live in, apartment buildings, are Bauhaus buildings. Under the Nazis, in spite of all this enmity, the Bauhaus, in fact, remained alive. In Italy, it became the dominant school of architecture. Yeah? It became dominant. But they were very important, yeah. Yeah.
What were the intellectual and political currents that, like the new art history and the new philosophy,
yeah,
the new philosophy specifically reacting against, like, how else is this approach?
What?
Positivism?
Yeah, logical positivism. You read again the culture of Western Europe, primarily, the dominant schools came from Vienna of logical positivism. And things of this nature reacted very strongly.
But in their emphasis on myths, how else is myth being approached, like, on the right in this period? I wasn't sure exactly.
Well, there again, it's in the culture of Western Europe, but it's the same sort of thing. All mass movements, it's Le Bon's myth, really applied to architecture. Otherwise, that mobs are moved by myth. The myth, what does Le Bon say? The myth of past history, the conservatism of past. That's all. And they believe that you should handle it rationally. Really, in a sense, the ball is one of their ancestors. Yeah? You have to put it that way. Yeah. But of course, what is in there also is not just a reaction. It's a continuation of German idealism. That is a continuation of the idealism of Hegel and others with our question, yeah? Which sees the world as mixed, yeah? And things like that. While, of course, the positivism, while it started in Vienna, found its home in England, in the English school of philosophy, while Wittgenstein and Riley and all these people, yeah? The English school of philosophy, which was carried to England from Austria by Wittgenstein, and who created the proponent became Bernard Russell, but also Riley and so on, yeah? And which then went to American universities, this department here and so on, for a long time, where logical positivism was the only philosophy taught. I have to say, it is the only philosophy taught. I don't know. You see what I mean? So it meant a rejection of the history of philosophy. This. It is a positivism. It is a rejection of the history of philosophy. It is a rejection of viewing philosophy historically, which of course Castira and all these people did, because they were interested in past myth as an explanation for the present. In other words, if you are going to capture myth rationally, then you have to do it through historical continuity and historical progression. You see, they were German ideas. So, I wouldn't say that we acted against logical positivism because it wasn't strong enough. That only typically enough became strong in the Anglo-Saxon world. It never became strong on the continent of Europe. I have to until today. But what's strong on the continent of Europe was, of course, the Castira philosophy and the new Marxism we talked about in all of this, and not logical positivism. Yeah? And not this positivism, the philosophy of Riley and Wittgenstein and people like that. Yeah? Which you see denies any, not only anything irrational, but denies anything unprovable according to their life. I'm not sure I understand it. I'm not sure anybody understands Wittgenstein. I'm not sure I understand Wittgenstein. But there is no doubt that it is a positivist, not right. Yes? And that it appeals to the English world and certainly not to the Germanic world. Because it's also in conflict with the Marxist revival. There is no bridge that leads to the Wittgenstein now. Yeah? You see, but Marxism is a historical philosophy, philosophy of consciousness, and not based on logic. Logical positivism is based on logic, and logic is proof, yes? Above all language.
So I took that now.
Yeah, anything else? Yes.
Can you elaborate on why you think someone is defining that as a proper practical ability?
Well, it's very much that's a very good question. And Martin Jane, this book doesn't really have an answer. There's personal answer. But the only thing you can say is that for any minority, this was a way to assimilate completely. I mean, this is an excellent way to assimilate, because it says the intellectuals must lead. It says that what counts is your consciousness, not your background, not your history. It's one way to enable you to fuse with the working class. That's amazing. So, I mean, that's the only explanation that makes any sense. Yes.
You mentioned the other day that it was largely the rhetoric of the social democrats which stopped liberals from joining their ranks.
Yeah.
Do you think if they had somehow gone beyond rhetoric, that there could have actually been a different outcome? And that liberals
Well, that's very hippie, you know. Yes, there could have been a different outcome if more people had been like Thomas Mann, which is admirable, who joined the Social Democratic Party, because he said that was the only bulwark against National Socialism, and he was, of course, totally right. So, but if more people have done that, perhaps, but that's a very hippie question. Perhaps, yes. It's a possibility. Because when the Nazis came to power, the Great Depression had already peaked. You know, things are already approved. But it's a minor thing. You can say that was really promised if the master, the more democratic right front, who was ruling, had a political instinct, which he lacked completely. If he had more of a political instinct, then he had a minor problem. That's a better way than saying that everybody joined the Social Democratic Party. But if everybody joined the Social Democratic Party, then not. But it had a problem with leadership. That's always the problem in a crisis. Leadership, you need an elite. So how does a nation fare without an elite? It's a very interesting study. So you can say many of America's problems are that America could never train up an elite. And you can say many of England's problems is that it did train up an elite. So, and a wrong one. You know anything about science and technology. So you can say, but still the problem of whether a nation can do without an elite is a very dubious problem. A nation probably needs an elite of some sort. It could get anywhere. And the Social Democrats are very bad at that. They didn't have any good leaders ever. And the right is not too bad at that because it doesn't have any democratic, any democratic anti-elite. So the right is always ready to the cargo of leaders. And they train them. Good or bad, they're ready with them. They have them. Yeah? And sometimes they even charismatic leaders, which the best with its democratic rationalism can ever show. I think that's one of the deeper problems. Anything else? Well, if we go to Spengler now, I think we must to the Decline of the West. So you have a book which had a tremendous impact, more I think in a way through its title than through its content. A book that was actually written during the war, and that was a direct reaction to the losing of the war. Now as far as we're concerned, or what we've talked about, what is so important about the Decline of the West, I think are three things. First of all, the biological determinism, which was popular in racial thought as well. The biological not associated with materialism, but the biological associated with metaphysical thought. That is to say, the kind of historical cycle and metaphysical cycle joining up together and directed against modernity. The idea, if you like, that only the metaphysical has real power, and the metaphysical is killed by modernity. Therefore, as Spengler put it, the great Germanic man was in the Middle Ages, before modernity. And he calls them, with another very famous saying, the Faustian man, because the Germanic man was like Faust. He reached out for the unknown. And that was the German man who built the Gothic cathedral. The Gothic cathedral, which in a way go into the unknown, is Germanic man reaching out into the unknown. The Faustian man, at the height of his biological excellence. And from then on, it's all the way downhill. As modernity comes, you have biological exhaustion. You have art styles like the Baroque, which are no longer serious. And then you have modernity and technology, which confine space. And Spengler has a lot to do with space. You can put it this way, that the Germanic man occupies the unknown spaces, the Gothic cathedral, the towers, turrets, whatnot. And that in the modern architecture, space is strictly limited. And this is part of the biological exhaustion. This is, of course, again, tied to German expansion. And if you like, German imperialism. That in the Middle Ages, Germany reached out to annex France and everything else, and in the modern, it's not only architecture which has a confined space, but man itself had a confined space also. The end is therefore in view, the war and the loss of the war is the final decline of Germanic man, it is the end of the biological cycle. And therefore, a new man will arise in Germany, and that new man will be new indeed. It will be the barbarian, a new type, the barbarian. The barbarians will roam the German countryside once the West has declined and restart Germanic world, restart from out of their own brute force, their own simplicity. They are all uncomplicatedness. This is very anti-intellectual, of course. Their own uncomplicatedness, their own simplicity, they will restart. So the decline of the West is not a pessimistic book. It's actually, in the end, an optimistic book. The new man, the new German, is being born. The decline is finished. And the new German, he will be a barbarian. Now, if you see parallels to Nietzsche here, you're quite correct, because this is much influenced by Nietzsche and Nietzsche's barbarians. For the new barbarian which will roam Germany once the war is over and once the West has declined will be without classes. He will be without hypocrisy. He will be a man of force. Now, about this image, it wouldn't be so important if it went more general than Spengler. In other words, what you have here is a kind of historical world picture in reaction against the war. A historical world picture built upon irrationalism. Something that has a name to it, and it's called metaphysical history or meta-history. That is to history considered as a metaphysical, irrational entity, meta-history, integrated into the biological life cycle. It is basically a racist idea. And it is therefore shared, if you will read again the culture of Western Europe, by racists, earlier racists, like Houston Stewart Chamberlain. But it is shared by many others as well. Is there any talk But it is chaired also by a man like Müller, M-O-E-L-L-E-R, Vandenbroek, who coined the famous phrase, the Third Reich. For Müller Vandenbroek has the same thing in his book, The Third Reich, which was published in about the same time, 1922-23, in which he has the same idea, except he puts it on Christian eschatological terms. The new barbarian is the Third Reich. The new barbarian issues in, which is in the book of Daniel, the Third Empire, the final Reich when the Germans were dominated. This is how the famous phrase, the Third Reich, first comes about. It comes about in a biological meta-historical analysis, which is based partly on Nietzsche, partly on the Bible, book of Daniel, partly on the Bible, kingdoms of the Bible, and which believes that the biological and historical life cycle has finished. The decline of the Germans is clear. He no longer occupies spaces. He is confined. Confined by architecture, confined by boundaries, confined by the bourgeoisie. Confined. While the Gothic man, for Müller too, the Gothic man still occupied spaces. He was Faust. He was a Faustian man. The symbol of one is the Gothic cathedral. The symbol of the other is the Baroque, the Monet, the theatrical Baroque, and that kind of thing. And the biological life cycle and the historical life cycle are linked, as it were. Secondly, the hope, therefore, is in the new. The hope is in the new man, the new barbarian. And what you have here, in fact, is what you had in Nietzsche, a kind of love of primitivism. You get it again in National Socialism everywhere. A lack of primitivism, these barbarians, uncomplicated, full of force, roaming the countryside like men. There's a very famous book after the war, which I don't have time to talk about, but I recommend to you, which is The Ancestors by Hans von Salomon, called The Questionnaire, where these barbarians come to life in the Nazi SS. And in fact, this happened for many of those, nearly a million, who voluntarily joined the Nazi SS, a brigade. Nearly a million of foreigners voluntarily joined the Nazi SS. And many of them saw in the Nazi SS this kind of barbarian, the new type of man, roaming around, full of force, vigor, and not complicated. This kind of a Spenglerian type, but a type for which Müller also yearned, a type indeed which for there was in general yearned. Now, Spengler puts this in a very famous slogan, of which I want to remind you, but which becomes basic to the European right, and the basic to letting go, basic to rejecting culture and rationality, basic to this idea of irrationality, the distinction between culture and civilization. And that distinction, which is so basic, you will read about in the culture of Western Europe, is of course that civilization is confined space. It is superficial. While culture is deep and metaphysical. Culture is a metaphysical entity. Civilization is superficial. Civilization, for Spengler, is the French Enlightenment. The French Enlightenment. Reason is superficial. Reason means confined space. Metaphysics is culture. It is German idealism. It is Hegel. It is the Faustian man. It is Goethe, not the classical Goethe, but the Goethe of Faust, the Goethe of the man who reaches and who always wants to read further, not the Faust who in the end comes to a sad end and can only be redeemed by reaching. This is the Faust, this is an exaltation of Faust as Faust, the restless, searching man, and not with Goethe's end, redeemed through a pure woman, none of this. The result of this distinction is, of course, very important. It is an attack on liberalism, which looks to France. It is an attack on all of these things that I've told you, including the Bauhaus, which wanted, as it were, to fuse culture and rationality. It gives in Germany, to the times of uncertainty, to the fact that life is a wager between revolution and counter-revolution, between all of those things that I've told you about, in the end, economic depression, all of these crises coming together. And so you get this summed up, this Spenglerian idea summed up, even while Spengler wrote in another very important tract by Thomas Mann called Confessions of an Unpolitical Man, which really sums this up, written during the war. The difference between the Geist, you see, the metaphysical is translated in German with the Geist. It's typically enough a word that has no English equivalent. Even Spengler would say has no culture, therefore it has no word for culture. So it has no equivalent for the guy. It just doesn't exist. Yeah.
What was the essay that Heinrich Mann wrote?
On Zola. But this is Geist means metaphysical depth. The difference between Geist and politics involves that between culture and civilization, the soulful and the social, between art and superficial literature. There is a term in German, Literat, superficial journalist. And this was written against his brother, Heinrich Mann, who had written an article on Zola. And this article on Zola, Thomas Mann thought was treason. It was treason to write in the war an article exalting positivism and the French Enlightenment in reason and all of this, and of course the article on Zola would. The difference between Geist and politics involves this between culture and civilization, the soulful and the social, art, and there is no word for literat, but I'll put it this way, art and journalism. The idea of the German is that of culture, the soul, not civilization, not society, not journalism. There is, Thomas Mann goes on, an immortally true opposition between music and politics, between the German idea and civilization. Now, on the one hand, therefore, is culture, all the metaphysical, true literature, music, the Germanic soul, the Faustian man, a true art. On the other side is reason. Reason is journalism, restlessness, never time for thought. Always the accusation against journalism as a Jewish affair. Restlessness, no time for thought. Superficial, but it's true of course. The next is art, metaphysical art. The other opposite to art is again superficial. He would say Bauhaus, a modern abstraction which has no soul. Abstract art, the Bauhaus, which has no soul at all. Now, what does that do to politics? It brushes aside politics as in the realm of civilization and not culture. Now, that is very important because you overcome the crisis how? You overcome the crisis not by joining present politics, but by advocating the new man. In other words, it doesn't depoliticize you, nothing does that really, but it makes a complete break with present politics. Because there is a political force to that. The new man is highly political, he's barbarian. He goes around, he beats up people. Yes, he's vigorous, he's uncomplicated, that is political. So all this talk about the unpolitical German is of course nonsense. That is from a liberal point of view. From a liberal point of view, this is unpolitical, but nothing is further from the truth. It is in reality a brick. It is what I have said, the wish for a fully furnished house in a crisis. For a brick, for a completely furnished house. which the maker has created. It has an answer for everything. It is a completely furnished house. It is not a matter of reason. And it gives you what people want in a crisis. Wide open space to occupy. That's what people want in a crisis. They don't want limited spaces. They want wide open spaces to occupy and to fill. That's why you have these marches. Why do you march to the capital? You march to the capital because there's a wide open space you want to fill. You yourself want to fill. You want to fill with your fear. You have that longing to fill the space. Why? Because it is there. That's why. But if you are a man of reason and rationality, you very carefully don't want to fill that space. You want to fill it with reason. In other words, to carry out my analogy, instead of marching to the square, shouting slogans invented by D'Annunzio and Mussolini for the most part, in your slogans, shouting slogans, you would cover it with books from one end to another. Now that would be a true intellectual protection. And in rationalism, you would cover it with books and you would ask your enemies, the racists, the radical right, to read these books, because your basis is to connect culture and rationality, yes? So you must go on the idea that everybody has a rational core, even if you are not, so then you have to ask these racists or these people, to read books, which themselves would maybe shock them out of their position, it's very respect, because it shocks them out. Anyhow, however that might be, what you have on the whole then here is, again, this irrationality. Now the point I want to make is this point. That if you tore asunder culture and rationality, as these people did, the artistic results are of course very poor. This is why my culture. Because the artistic results are poor. This definition of art and music leads to neo-romanticism. It leads to landscape painting. It leads to romantic music. It doesn't lead to modern art. In other words, it's totally irreconcilable to any avant-garde. So the artistic results are poor, very poor indeed. But the political results and the cultural results of vast importance. Because tearing asunder culture and rationality really does the following thing. And here, Spengler is typical, Müller and his Third Reich are typical. What does it do? Let us summarize. First of all, it opposes reason to truth, reason to the depth of the soul. And it emphasizes the soul. Secondly, it ties into nationalism. That is clear. It ties into nationalism. It's expansionism, nationalism's emphasis on the soul, the national character, the biology. In fact, it ties into racism. Spengler, as a matter of fact, was not a racist, but it certainly ties into racism with its biological end. Well, I come to that. Thirdly, it fuses history. It gives history both a dimension in space and biology. It connects history to space and biology and becomes something called meta-history. You know, that's not so odd. As you might think, even today, there are a lot of people, who have these idiotic, these kinds of explanations of history, that all history is due to the past domain or that we are biologically exhausted. Even Kautsky believed that is so wrong. Kautsky said something my father used to say to me, that tired old Jewish blood, you have to marry a peasant girl to fresh it up. And indeed, Kautsky reversed it. He married a Jewish girl so to freshen up her blood with his. So that was very deep, that if you have tired Jewish blood, you'd better marry a peasant girl. Even Kautsky was very strong on that subject, by the way. So that your tired old blood would be freshened up. Recommend it. I mean, all this is free of cost. So anyway, however that may be, this was very deep. But that is meta-history. Biology and history is thing. There is a decline, you see. There is a decline. decline, and to get rid of this decline, you had better, you know what, it's kind of girl. That's why people like me in our status always have what we call nursemaids, or whose breast you suck, what we call wet nurses. Our wet nurses were always from the country. That's why you see me as physically strong. I was nourished on good Prussian milk, coming country. I never mind. However that might be, or the trouble you can say. However that might be, the theory behind it was clear. The theory behind it is that would dilute my tired old blood. Give it you bigger. Never mind. Anyhow, the third idea that is, this is meta-history. This is meta-history, which in crisis always comes up, because people want a fully furnished book. It always comes up in a crisis. And lastly, it becomes, of course, it has a way out, it has a solution. And the solution is a typical solution. It is not more reason, not at all. It is the new man and the new primitive man. The new man who can refresh your mind. Yes? The myth. It goes back, of course, nothing is new in history. I might have told you that before. It goes back to Nietzsche's vision, but it dilutes it with the vision of Arcadia. You know, when Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI played shepherd and shepherdess. The vision of the peasant girl, yes, the milkmaid, you know what I mean, fresh blood, and all of that sort of stuff. What you have there is a kind of Arcadian vision, is at the end of Spengler. What declines is the West. And here, of course, they are opposed to bourgeois society. And what that is in the last regard is a continuation of something we've studied so long. The bourgeois, anti-bourgeois revolution, which we studied and which we talked about. That is a revolution that is against the bourgeoisie, but not economically or socially. But in thought, it tries to substitute, in other words, another analysis than the social and economic analysis. It tries, in fact, to substitute the new man. You have that already in expressionism, the quest for the new man. And you have it in all this. It is one of the characteristics of this bourgeois, anti-bourgeois revolution. Indeed, it is its solution to the class struggle. It is its solution, the new man. And the new man in this case, it was Nietzsche's solution, remember, the barbarian. And the new man in this case is the barbarian. The barbarian, uncomplicated, and all of that I have told you. Finally, the barbarian is, of course, also young. It fits in very well with the cult of youth, what I have tried to tell you. The biological cycle works this way. You are more vigorous in your youth, and the Germans were more vigorous in their youth, which was the Middle Ages. That's when they were vigorous. That's when they built the Gothic cathedral. So it fits in with the worship of youth. Meta-history fits in with that. The whole biological circle is a biological circle of youth. The Third Reich will be a Reich of youth. These barbarians are youthful figures. They are figures of youth. And eventually it becomes, in Müller Vandenbroek, a very famous metaphor between young and old nations. The young nations, like Germany, who are now renewing themselves, and the old nations. Now that coincides with reality. Germany was unified very recently. And in Italy, when you had the same idea, was unified very recently, and both lost the war. So it was a very comforting idea that we may have lost the war, but we're young nations. Look at England and France and the Jews and so on. Very old. Their biological circle is coming to a close. Ours has come to a close and is renewing it. So you get very strongly that famous idea of the old and the young nation, and the young nation being the nation of expansion, of imperialism, of occupation, of vigor and virility. All of this, I think, is of greatest importance It is a disgust with society, which you have there. As Spengler said in his book, we have to have contact with living reality, contact with nature, with children, with dogs and cats, not with young people stuffed with theoretical learning. There again, you see, the genuine, not the milkmaid, or dogs and cats and all of that sort of thing, rather than theoretical learning. It's the longing for the genuine in a situation which is, of course, a very polar and difficult situation, which must be clear. This typology you can find in others, like Jünger, who has a type simply called the worker. But the worker in Jünger is like the barbarian. He simply thinks he's more sophisticated. He thinks the barbarian is already here. He's the industrial worker. The industrial worker, who is a stereotype, he is really the new barbarian, the new man of vigor, and he will renew it. But it is just the same thing, whether it is Jünger's industrial worker or Spengler's barbarian, makes great a difference. They are both a cut of the same, a clock. Now, having said all of this about Spengler, and having now today torn asunder culture and rationality, we must now ask a final question about life. What about Christianity? For after all, you can see how this goes with nationalism. You can see how the rationalism goes with Marxism and socialism. You can see the liberalism. But after all, this civilization was still, when all is said and done, a Christian civilization. What happened to Christianity? Is it an attempt now, after the war, to reinforce culture and rationality? And the answer is yes, on the Catholic side. Through Neo-Thomism, which again you will be able to read, I will say that, through Jacques Maritain, and what we call the New Thomism on the Catholic side. Yes. On the Catholic side, I would say there is, because of the Catholic tradition, St. Thomas and Scholasticism, a new scholasticism, a new attempt to reinforce culture and rationality with Jacques Maritain in France, above all in France, in Cartesian France. But this revival, in the end, was going to be pretty stymied and become really the new orthodoxy, the new orthodoxy of the Church, in Thomism. But looking enough, the revival of Catholicism takes place in France, and therefore in a country with a Cartesian and logical tradition. And therefore it becomes a Thomist revival. But the strong revival of Protestantism after the war takes part in Germany. And it is perhaps an even more important revival, because it again will eventually affect even Catholicism to a certain extent. And it is, of course, really at first related to Spengler, to the tearing aside, because it is a Lutheran revival. And Luther's basic idea, you know, is the separation of politics from faith. So Lutheranism, with its separation from politics from faith, which Luther attempted, was very close to the tearing aside of culture and civilization. But what is interesting about the Protestant revival, to which I'll come on Monday, of Karl Barth and Paul Tillich and others, which has also made American Protestantism, is the fact that in spite of that, they eventually tried again to connect culture and rationality. That despite of Luther's idea, that I'm free even when in prison, a hymn some of you may have sung at one time, which typifies all. I want to talk to you at some length about the parish house and the importance of the parish house for German culture. This was gold for politics. In spite of that, effectively, they made a connection. And it is worth talking about that, because that became the dominance of American Protestantism. It was carried by refugees from the Nazis to America And you might say, quite rightly, that before Paul Tillich came to America, American Protestantism had no theology. It was a poor pragmatism. It was a stupid thing like do good. Why do you have to go to church to do good? But it's now got a theology. So this is important for America as well, and to do. Thank you.